The rise of an American Jewish intelligentsia began with the influx of Jewish immigrants who crowded into New York at the turn of the 19th century, bringing many young people with ambitions of becoming writers and creative thinkers, as was natural for a people that ascribed the highest value to intellectual activity. The newspaper was itself a hybrid form of information and entertainment, commerce and ideology, persuasion and accommodation, individual expression for the mass market. The Yiddish newspaper had further to negotiate between the European past and the American present, between staying Jewish and becoming American. So tonight our subject is Levick, Hey Levick, and usually what I've tried to do and what I will probably do in the rest of these talks is to give a person in the round to try to present as much of a writer and an intellectual as I can. Tonight I thought I'd do something a little bit different. There's so much of Levick to talk about, but I wanted to concentrate really on one thing in particular, and that is one of his plays. So that's the approach of this evening, and with that I will start, however, with him. One of the most famous Yiddish writers of his time, Levick Halpern, was born in 1888 in Igumen, near Minsk, in today's Belarus. Raised and educated traditionally, he became caught up at a very early age in the politics of the Jewish Socialist Bund. He was arrested at 17 for anti-Tsarist activism, and spared as a juvenile at that point, but then he was arrested again, and that time he was sentenced to lifetime exile in Siberia. From there, he managed a bold escape, and in 1913, at 25, he made his way to New York, a year before Jacob Glatstein, whom we spoke of last time. There, in this cauldron of literary activity, he began publishing his poems, taking the inverted name of Hey Levick in order not to be confused with the already popular Yiddish poet Moshe Leib Halpern. But he was uniquely present in many of his poems, including on the roads of Siberia. Even now, this is the poem, even now, on the roads of Siberia, you can find a button, a shred of one of my shoelaces, a belt, a bit of broken cup, a leaf of scriptures. Even now, on the rivers of Siberia, you can find some trace, a scrap of the raft the river swallowed. In the woods, a bloodied swatch, dried stiff, some frozen footprints in the snow. So, just as Elie Wiesel's writings and personality would later make him the canonical survivor witness of the Shoah, Levick figured as the hero of the Jewish Socialist Bund and survivor conscience of Russia's revolutionary movement. But Levick was also after something much larger. And rather than trace his literary development, which, by the way, I think is a wonderful prospect for whoever would like to undertake it, I'm going to linger here on one of his works, until now his most influential. In 1921, he published The Golem, a poetic drama in 8 scenes that he had been working on for several years. In 1924, his play was performed in Hebrew by the Habima Theater in Moscow. In 1928, in Polish, in both Lublin and Warsaw. And in 1931, in its original Yiddish, in New York. Since then, it remains a staple of Jewish and international theater. In 1962, the New York City Opera premiered The Golem, an opera by Abraham Elstein, based on Levick's play. I'm certain that the current anxiety over artificial intelligence will revive interest in this theme of the empowered creature, and hopefully it will also revive interest in this dramatic work. Now, the legend of the golem, a creature formed out of clay and programmed to rescue imperiled humans, can be traced back to Talmudic and Kabbalistic sources. In German culture, it figures from the folk tales of the brothers Grimm to the early 20th century novel The Golem by Gustav Meyrink, and that novel's silent film adaptation by Paul Wegener under the title The Golem, How He Came Into the World. Now, Wegener's horror film, that's the way it is usually described, was released in New York in 1921, the same year as Leivik's text. Meanwhile, Chaim Bloch, a yeshiva student turned businessman who had been conscripted into the Austrian army and was serving on the front during the First World War, was moved to write a collection of Yiddish stories, The Prager Golem, The Golem of Prague, that appeared in English translation in 1920. Leivik was probably familiar not only with Wegener's movie, but also with the Hebrew version of the same legends that had been used by Bloch, Wonders of the Maharal with the Golem by Rabbi Yudel Rosenberg, that was published in Warsaw in 1909. Now, Maharal, as many of you may know, is a Hebrew acronym for Rabbi Yehuda Lau of Prague. And he was a scholar and mystic whose dates are about 1525 to 1609. And he had been woven into this legend as the creator and eventual destroyer of the golem, a creature formed by him specifically to protect the Jews of Prague from the imminent danger of a local blood libel that had that was going to incite pogroms against the Jews. Rosenberg's book purported to be the manuscript of the Maharal's son-in-law and has only recently been exposed as Rosenberg's own invention. Now, he may have felt that he was merely extending the tradition of inventing legends that were never intended as history. And in fact, Rabbi Lau, the Maharal, though he studied mysticism, was never known to have engaged in Kabbalistic practices. And the Jews of Prague during his time, under then ruling Emperor Rudolf II, lived peacefully, actually. So indeed, the emperor and the Maharal are said to have met in 1592 for a discussion of Kabbalah. So this is an extraordinarily interesting background because of the invention of the golem in this form. The figure was always there. The concept was always there. But here it is interwoven with this historical background that is not really historically accurate. Now, the point for our purposes is that the golem theme was everywhere by the time Leivik wrote and published his own version. And danger to the Jews had been mounting steadily from the start of the Russian pogroms of 1881 through the pogroms of Kishinev and Homel at the start of the 20th century and to the mass slaughters of the First World War and the Civil War in Russia, as we've already noted in this series. These horrors had drawn many people to the idea of revolutionary action. Sectors of the Jewish Labor Bund and the Zionists organized units of Jewish self-defense. Zev Jabotinsky organized a Jewish legion that fought in five battalions of the British Army. Yiddish and Hebrew writers took up the subject of how to respond to violence, and debates pro and con Jewish military engagement raged across Jewish society. Leivik would draw on the angst of all of this, along with a wide range of Talmudic lore and Jewish myth, to dramatize the need for action and the dangers lying between intention and outcome. A drama about the efficacy of Jewish power could not have been better timed. Now, the work itself, Here is a scene-by-scene scaffolding, just for your orientation. Scene one, the golem is created. Scene two, he becomes part of the household of this creator, the Maharal of Prague, who tries to domesticate him as Yosele, his servant. The golem is attracted to Dvora, the Maharal's granddaughter. Scene three, the Jewish community reacts to the golem. Like Dvora, they are frightened by his appearance, by his strangeness. Scenes 4 to 6 are in the fifth tower, a ruin on the outskirts of the city, which is inhabited by beggars, undesirables, including poorer Jews. The priest, Thaddeus, is planning to drive the Jews from this place where they are looking for their last place of possible refuge. The Maharal, in scene 5, chases off the old and young beggar, who is the Messiah, who has come to bring the community salvation. But the Maharal chases him off. Scene 6, the golem is in the fifth tower, and he chases off Thaddeus, who comes to drive the Jews away. In scene 7, we have a cave with other saviors, and the golem foils the plot of the priest Thaddeus. And scene 8, the golem is uncreated. So, some exposition of this. Levix the Golem, as he describes it, is set in Prague, 17th century, and it does not pretend to history. That is made abundantly clear by the introduction of more supernatural elements than just the golem itself. In a time of danger, when the perpetual Jewish wait for redemption has grown especially acute, this is the thing that the Maharal wants to do to save the community. Anticipating trouble, he creates him. And the drama, however, opens in such heightened tension that one wonders from the very beginning how this 70-year-old Maharal could have undertaken the feat. And indeed, having shaped the clay figure that lies before him, he is immediately filled with doubt about bringing it to life. And he says, "But who am I to say my hands have shaped? Blind was I until you gave me sight." Well aware that God alone is the creator and that God alone bestows life, the rabbi has tried but failed to secure God's blessing for this intended deed. But now he knows that he has not gotten it, and by proceeding without divine assurance, he knows he is challenging the divine order. Now this Jewish challenger to divine authority shows no hubris or the kind of exaltation that we find in comparable literary and philosophical rebels, like Satan in John Milton's Paradise Lost, or Prometheus in Shelley's poem by that name, or Goethe's Faust, or Nietzsche's Superman in Thus Spake Zarathustra. Whereas those figures exude energy and determination, the Maharal is visited instead by several imagined figures projecting his fears and self-doubts. And among them is the villainous Thaddeus, the head monk who is conspiring to destroy the Jews, who says accusingly, as he sees the Maharal in this moment of creation, "What causes that strange look in your eyes? Murder in a rabbi's eyes? I have seen in dungeons, at the stakes of holy courts, so many faces of so many Jews, but I have never chanced to see two Jewish eyes that looked upon me with true fury, with murderous rage and hate as yours do now. They seem the eyes of some golem run wild." So in these lines, Levick has Thaddeus, ostensibly the very force that the golem is being created to oppose, speak as part of the Maharal's own doubting conscience even before he has brought this creature to life. Indeed, as the poem proceeds, we continue to see the Golem's creator, beset by scruples. We might call them Jewish scruples because they are specifically stated as such. Scruples about the power that he is about to unleash. The literary critic Shmuel Niger, who was Leivik's friend and biographer, suggests that the Maharal's uncertainty in creating the golem was actually to be read as the creative writer's own reservations and Leivik's uneasiness about airing this subject. And no doubt there is more than one source of anxiety for this play. Now, a second set of difficulties in the creation of the golem was brought to life in the Habima Theater's Hebrew language production, which I was actually privileged to see in the late 1950s. Seems like a long time ago to you, maybe, but not so long to me. So for the entry on stage of the fully formed golem, this is, you remember now, in the second act, played by Aharon Meskin, the stage directions read, "He is taller than the doorway, and he does not know enough to bend." And just so, center stage, a huge figure stood outside the doorframe as the rabbi downstage was coaching him on how to bow, then enter, then straighten up. It was incredibly moving to see this creature so big and strong, yet so dumb and helpless, and to grasp the problem of partnership between a weak old man and his strong but infantile servant. When Leivik was once asked about the figure of the golem, he said it expressed the suffering of the lonely individual. For his part, the Maharal needs power to protect against the threat of the community, and in courageously seizing the initiative, he assumes sole responsibility for what could be a transgressive act. Meanwhile, his serviceable creature longs for the power to love and to be loved. Leivik introduces the figure of Dvoirele, the rabbi's granddaughter, who first awakens and then thwarts the golem's need for companionship and affection. So you see him striving to be really human in human terms. The question of what it means to be human is thus opened from both sides, the rabbi's impotence, the golem's mere instrumentality. In the face of this dramatic division between two extremes, the condition of man, of the human creature, appears very frail indeed, and we feel the pathos of our creatureliness, the solitude, the dependency, and above all, the confusion of this situation, of this condition. So the main plot, having brought the golem to life as Joseph, or Yossel the woodcutter, which would account for the axe that he is going to have to wield, the Maharal sends him out to function normally until he may be needed. The socio-political or national dimension of the plot will actually determine whether a golem can in fact save the Jews. And herein lies the main choice for any author who is treating this golem legend in this particular form of the Prague story. Is it up or down? Will he or won't he save the community? More broadly, what's the relationship between the protective force and the community it is meant to protect? Legends about a Frankenstein creature could move in either direction. And Leivik seems to equivocate. Just before the two coinciding annual holidays of Passover and Easter, the monk Thaddeus set up the traditional blood libel by arranging for the placement of a container of blood, literally at the synagogue's door. Through an underground passage, tunnel, we might have in mind, through an underground tunnel, he sets a trap for the Jews of Prague and frames them for a crime by situating the murdered child's blood, a child obviously murdered not by the Jews of Prague, as proof that the Jews plan to use it for the baking of Passover matzahs. That was the traditional blood libel. In a phantasmagoric scene, the spirits of the cave in that underground passage struggle with the golem, who has been instructed to remove the bottle from where it was planted. After a great struggle with the spirits of the tunnel cave, the golem prevails, his mission is accomplished, the community is spared. But no credit accrues to the savior or to his master. The golem is driven near mad in this struggle and has trouble even recognizing the rabbi. Having been exposed to blood, the creature turns against those whom he was meant to protect. In the play's final scene, and I am here only tracing the main plot, right? So in the play's final scene, he breaks into the synagogue where the Jews are welcoming the Sabbath. He attacks them until he is subdued by the Maharal, who assumes responsibility for the murders. The Maharal says, "What have you done? Does your mind grasp that? Tell me." The golem, "I have spilled blood." The Maharal, "Are you aware whose blood it was you spilled?" Golem, "Jewish blood." The Maharal, "On my head falls the blood, on my head. He came to save, and yet he shed our blood. Are we thus punished for our joy, O Lord? Are we chastised because we wish to save ourselves? Did you not grant approval? Was this not done through you? Why then such castigation? Or did you only wish to try me? Did you reveal to me the more than human? Allow me to create, to rule, command, only that I might see at last my insignificance, my massive sin? And more than that, my sin against all Jews? That, in impatience and despair, I wished to turn my back on those ways of your people that are eternal, gentle, patient, full of faith, my sin in wanting what the foe lays claim to? The foe demanded what was his. The blood that I desired to save, I shed." Now, eternal, gentle, patient, full of faith, these are the values of politically dependent Jewish generations. Values that the Maharal seems to endorse when he then returns the golem to its inanimate state. In the absence of any countervailing voice at the end, and as the drama's conclusion, this passage serves as a verdict on the rabbi's deed. Now, Levick here exposes the third rail of Jewish history, the forever expected but never enacted redemption. In quiet times, the Jewish way of life is its own reward. In times of physical danger, the expectation of messianic intervention, of Jewish faith in God's intervention, is triggered to no avail. The Messiah has made an appearance here, and as we will go on to discuss, but the Maharal makes it clear that this is his problem to solve. And in solving it, you see, he takes the blame on himself for the methods that he sought. So the subplot, the middle section of this poetic drama, which, by the way, is usually eliminated in stage productions, is essential to Levick's map of ideas around the question of security or salvation or politics and faith. Prague's Jews, in the grip of fear, try to understand why they are being targeted. "What do they want of us?" a congregant asks the rabbi. "Tell me quite simply. I wish to understand." At his most cynical, the Maharal replies, or maybe this isn't cynicism, but in any case, the Maharal replies that the Jews are hated because Gentiles believe the Jews could liberate the world if they wish to, but they refuse, because what the world wants is to be free of us. Namely, we could only liberate the world by freeing the world of ourselves. A second congregant, ironically named Tanchum, which means bringer of comfort, recounts losing his son to the local mob during a previous Passover pogrom. Parodying the religion of the killers, he calls on his son to rise from the dead. But they, the tormentors, do not fail to rise to kill his son all over again. He says, again they stab his left eye through, hack his right arm at the elbow, hack his left arm at the shoulder. I lay him back into the chariot and I say, until next year, because my heart is filled with pity for the world. So this is Tanchum the Comforter, who is eternally there to keep sacrificing his Jewish son to the Gentiles who need this. Tanchum thinks of himself as the ultimate watchman, having gone beyond fear into half madness. For him, the redemption is already too late, and Jews serve the world by being its victims. Martyrology, by the way, played a very large part in Levick's thinking, and he always sided with the victims, yet he knew the false temptation of equating martyrdom with goodness, as if Jews served the Gentiles by letting themselves be killed. The question, what do they want of us, prompts the related question of Jewish compliance. Thaddeus the priest is both a philosopher and a practical anti-Jew. In advance of the blood libel, he comes to drive the Jewish beggars from the fifth tower, where they have found refuge. No matter how bedraggled and demoralized, these Jews still provoke his resentment. He says, they live like lords, as though they own the place. And in the play's longest speech, he levels a reverse accusation, blaming Jewish passivity for inciting his hatred. Have we not tortured you enough, oppressed you, burnt you, led you to the slaughter? We have grown weary of our hatred, of our cruelty and fury, yet you parade your zealotry before us and clench your teeth in obstinate tenacity. Zealotry, tenacity, pity for the world. These were the very flaws that Jewish activists had been attacking in the behavior of Jews like Tanchum. Does not the lamb's meekness excite the appetite of the lion? Why are you asking for it? Here, these accusations of passivity are accusations in the twisted thinking of an anti-Semite. We burn you at the stake, though innocent. Why do you go to burn as though to dance? Why do you not attack us as we do you with torch and axe? Where is there one among you with the courage to step forward, seize my staff, and break it on my skull? The cruel mockery. This seems to confirm the Maharal's need to create the golem in the first place. So in his first test, the golem does save the community by driving Thaddeus, their pursuer, from the tower. The strategy of physical protection seemed at that point to have worked. Now, one of the hardest tasks facing Jewish writers has always been the creation of a credible anti-Semite. They are far more familiar with blameworthy Jews than with the thinking of their accusers. As members of a self-limiting minority, they tend more to accuse themselves, or of course to accuse their fellow Jews, right, than to indict others. Levick's contribution to the genre is an eloquent hater, some of whose criticisms were leveled by the Jews themselves. And yet, no matter how obvious the scheming of Thaddeus makes the need for Jewish self-defense, the evidence of the play swings ultimately against the Maharal's intervention. In their final scene, when the rabbi must go to join his congregants in welcoming the Sabbath, the golem pleads with him to stay, not to abandon him. Had the rabbi stayed with him always, the golem would not have run amok. The master creator is made to realize that his creature's protection depends on forever remaining at this creature's service. Whatever help the golem provides is offset by the sacrifice required to keep his power under control. So along similar lines, the Maharal distrusts insistence on the messianic coming. Upon discovering that the old beggar, who is the prophet Elijah, and the young beggar, the Messiah himself, have come to the fifth tower, he, the Maharal, chases them off. "You hurried here," he says. "Then hurry back. I order it." They have come to bring salvation. But he has created the golem because it is not yet time for the ultimate redemption, for the coming of the Messiah. The Maharal's and Levik's distrust of the messianic coming is in keeping with the quietist rabbinic tradition that warns against hastening the end of history. Levik expands the warning against eschatology in this amazing underground scene where the golem is ordered to thwart Thaddeus by removing the blood that is the evidence incriminating the Jews. In this sequence, the cave spirits warn that the taste of blood inflames even those who try to prevent its shedding. The golem's two fellow redeemers in this scene are also present. You know who they are? The man with the cross is one of those potential redeemers, and the young beggar, the Jewish Messiah, who says, "We must renew old friendship. We three must be here." Yes, three, 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 and sit here hip to hip. The world goes its way, we go ours. No one is between us. The madness of the final, final, final wonders will itself protect us. Attend to what I say, O nailed one on your cross. We shape a peace, P-E-A-C-E, a peace forever from today. Now, Levik may have wanted to include this theme of Jewish kinship with Christianity to offset the very damning portrait of the priest Thaddeus, the man with the cross, who can but bless and forgive and understand, is accepted into this circle of redeemers, yearning for the ecumenical spirit that will bring peace to the world and to the Jews, is included here as a big part of the Jewish hope for salvation. Still, the redeemers do not emerge from the cave to redeem the world. And were he not forced by the Maharal to perform his mission, the golem would have preferred to stay underground with the others. Now, in all honesty, I do not pretend to understand everything that Levik includes in this fantastic scene, which gives voice to competing Jewish visions of salvation, none of which is ultimately realized. The inspired leader, strong enough to bring physical protection, however, realizes that this was incompatible with the traditional way of ensuring Jewish survival. If this is also about the creative writer who wants to create a redemptive work, he too admits defeat and returns to the synagogue for Sabbath prayers, which is how the play ends, with the Maharal having put the golem back to sleep forever, and he returning to the synagogue to lead the prayers of the congregation. Now, I think here that Levik dramatizes what the philosopher Leo Strauss was to observe four decades later, namely, that the root of injustice lies in the free action of God's creatures, in men like Thaddeus, and that the Jews' experience at their hands testifies to the non-appearance of redemption. Strauss said, "This, one could say, is the meaning of the chosen people. The Jews are chosen to prove the absence of redemption." Now, this was not the message that Levik's cohort wanted to hear. So, a quick note on the reception of the play, at least in one sector. Since most of the supernatural material was omitted from the stage production of Leivick's play, its stripped-down main plot, focused on the fate of the golem, was widely considered to be a referendum on the use of political force. Some people, taking a cue from Leivick's prominence in the Jewish Socialist Bund, contemporized the theme of the creature with an axe as the use of the Bolshevik means for revolutionary ends. In this interpretation, the Maharal's attempted intervention in history could represent the idealistic side of communism, while his creation of the golem was its mistaken, murderous deviation. What with the Bolshevik Revolution and the founding of the Soviet Union, communism itself became one of the most divisive Jewish issues during the interwar years, and the golem figured in that debate. In 1925, just after the Habima staging of the golem in Moscow, and just before the Habima left the Soviet Union, very happily for all involved, to come to what was then already Tel Aviv, Leivick was invited to the Soviet Union. And there, a large literary gathering in his honor was chaired by Moshe Litvakov, the editor of the newspaper Emes, the official counterpart of Pravda. After greeting him politely at this large gathering, Litvakov took the liberty of publicly informing the playwright that he should not have been afraid of Yosele's axe because it holds the power of the revolution, the power that will clear away all obstacles and those who stand in our way. Yosele's axe is the axe that we all bless. And thus encouraged by the chairman, members of the audience wanted to know why he, Leivick, had the golem killed instead of allowing him to prevail. To them, it was clear that the golem represented the Jewish proletariat, while the Maharal stood for Jewish clericalism and Jewish bourgeoisie. They said to him, "We hate a creature that lets itself be overpowered while he has an axe in his hand." It was clear to these communists that in a time of revolution, Leivick had written a conservative, if not a reactionary, play. Yet, nothing in the text suggests that he intended the golem as a metaphor for any militant movement. In an attempt to explain himself, Leivick said that the light over the golem was his play's messianic theme, that without that light, right, the golem must die. Rather, so thickly had Leivick layered his scenes with metaphysical considerations that the work fairly begged to be read on a quasi-theological plane. All the historical and supernatural parts converge on Geulah, redemption, the theme that preoccupied Leivick from the start to the end of his literary life, and he insisted that the play not be reduced to a dramatization of a temporal struggle, precisely the sort of struggle that, if anything, he aimed to prevent. So how then did Leivick remain in the Soviet sphere of influence for much of the interwar period, zigzagging with the shifts of Soviet policy? And the answer lies with the Yiddish writer whose formative experience and liberal inclinations kept him loyal to the movement that professed to represent the oppressed, that was him on the one hand, and on the other, the increasingly duplicitous turns of Soviet policy in pretending to serve the oppressed. It also mattered greatly that Leivick was tubercular, diagnosed as far advanced in 1932 and confined to a sanatorium in Denver for almost all of the next 3 years. His illness worked in complex ways to draw him deeper into the theme and the reality of suffering. Tuberculosis was then widely ascribed to the abuses of capitalism, the global economic order that was said to exploit its workers and thereby cause their fatal illness. But there was also socialism in the land of Israel. In 1937, when he was well enough to take his first trip to pre-state Palestine, and like Abraham Kahan a dozen years earlier, he realized what a personal stake he had in this dream turning into reality. welcomed there by the Histadrut, the national labor union that functioned as a government in waiting. He said that he felt more like a resident than a visitor. And he said, quote, a generation has sprouted here and see what it has created. This country is strong because it is creating a new Jewish way of life, new Jewish treasures, and a new Jewish framework that gives new form to the whole Jewish world. Strong was an ailing man's highest compliment. At the same time, mourning the neglect of Yiddish, he worried that the very strength of Israel might doom the weak diaspora culture that had given it birth. So Levick's prominence as a man of the left complicated his reaction to the shifts in Soviet policy, which was anti-Zionist and anti-liberal until the Communist Party mandated the Popular Front in 1936, encouraging alliance with the socialists and with Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Democratic Party. And you notice that it was after that that Levick went to Palestine, after the Popular Front had been introduced. Then, however, came the Hitler-Stalin Pact of 1939, the greatest blow to Jewish communists and to the thousands of fellow travelers who had justified their support of Stalin's purges on the grounds that the Soviet Union was the arch enemy of Nazi Germany. When Hitler then betrayed Stalin and attacked the Soviet Union in 1941, it allowed Jews on the left to move back into the pro-communist fold. Stalin exploited his star Yiddish writers and cultural figures to help him secure American aid during the war. Once the war was over, Stalin purged these Soviet spokesmen as ruthlessly as he had done tens of thousands of invented traitors in the 1930s. Their close ties with the Yiddish writers and the Soviet Union made those purges a personal blow, I would say a second churban, a second destruction to the leftist Yiddish writers of America. Levick's instinctive sympathy with the oppressed, filtered through socialist ideology, sometimes aligned him with the Soviet Union, but his conscience remained primarily that of a Jew. And of course, from the start of the war, Levick felt himself entirely bound to those in the ghettos and the concentration and death camps, and he wrote passionately about them. Afterwards, reflecting back on that 1925 evening in Moscow, Levick wrote that his then host, Litvakov, who had been falsely accused and executed in 1939, that he could not have imagined that one day his head would be chopped off with the axe that he had blessed. Levick knew that had he accepted the invitation they had then extended to him to move to the Soviet Union, he would have been one of those executed. Although they did not add up to Jewish salvation, Levick came to bless the State of Israel and his American citizenship. Torn between loyalty to the sufferers and resistance to a cult of martyrdom, he dramatized not the war between good and evil, but the struggle of how to confront evil. And I'll end with this poem that urges his fellow Jews never to let themselves be perceived as victims. And this was written just at the start of the Second World War, when the fate of the Jews in Poland was already all too ominous, although not yet settled. Have this poem. Come, let us hide ourselves in caves, in stony crevices, in graves, where stretched full length on the hard ground we lie, backs up and faces down. We shall not record, we shall not say why we've immured ourselves this way. No notch in a wall, our stony page shall mark the historic year or age. We shall not leave behind as a clue one thread of ourselves, not a lace of a shoe. No one shall find, hard though he look, one shred of a dress, one page of a book. The poet here evokes his earliest poems in which the escaping prisoner had left these very signs of himself on the Siberian steppes, but now declaring that they, the Jews of his time, are going to foil the discoverer of their intertwined bodies by refusing to be known. This is a kind of Masada, defying the Gentile world by denying it the satisfaction of comprehension. And should someone come upon their bodies, let him never know why they had to escape or how they were killed. Let their discoverer flee in terror before the mystery. If he asks, are bones mixed one with the other? Are you the bones of a foe or a brother? The answer will come, horror-struck dumb, and from his own mouth, white bubbles of foam. Long will he stare, not comprehending, till he turn, eyes bulging, arms extending, to flee in his fear and consternation from generation to generation. The greater his fear, the faster his flight, running till history flounder in night, while we go on lying as heretofore, a stubborn back and nothing more. So here is resistance, not by a golem-wielding axe, nor by Glotzdane slamming the gate on the big stinking world, but of a people doomed in everything but historical reckoning. Levick might have been thinking of the priest Thaddeus, who is tortured by the mystery of Jewish survival. Well then, let our stubbornness drive him mad. Let the descendants of those responsible for these corpses know the Jews only by their backside. What would Levick have made of American Jewry's urge to have all Americans study the Holocaust as though that were some civilizing instruction? Well, I went looking for interpretations of the Jews as a stiff-necked people. I think that's the hard quality that Levick was here resurrecting. And I found a talk by the late Rabbi Jonathan Sacks that quotes the interpretation by Rabbi Yitzchak Nissenbaum of how Moses persuaded God to give this stiff-necked people a second chance after their worship of the golden calf. And Rabbi Nissenbaum puts these words into Moses' mouth. Almighty God, look upon this people with favor, because what is now their greatest vice will one day be their greatest, their most heroic virtue. They are indeed an obstinate people, but just as now they are stiff-necked in their disobedience, so one day they will be equally stiff-necked in their loyalty. Nations will call on them to assimilate, but they will refuse. Mightier religions will urge them to convert, but they will resist. They will suffer humiliation, persecution, even torture and death because of the name they bear and the faith they profess. But they will stay true to the covenant their ancestors made with you. They will go to their deaths saying, Ani Mamin, I believe. This is a people awesome in its obstinacy. And though now it is their failing, there will be times far into the future when it will be their noblest strength. And Rabbi Sacks adds, the fact that Rabbi Nissenbaum lived and died in the Warsaw Ghetto gives added poignancy to his words. So I think this captures the spirit of Levick's final years. If he could not have redemption, he did not want to settle for any kind of sympathy or understanding. And though he spent so much of his creative effort defending the weak, he did so in the name of Jewish resistance. The creator of the golem ended on a note of resolution. And so should we. Thank you.